Welcome to Lumber Dandy and Friends, everybody. My name is Benjamin David, and I'm glad you're here, because have I got a story for you today. Now, since this is our first episode, let me just explain that it's an adventure fiction podcast telling new tall tales and legends about the one and only Lumber Dandy and his larger-than-life companions. Now, the first couple episodes are available now, and it's a sort of serial-ish story, so we'll be sharing a new chapter of season one with you just about every week for a while, and I hope you enjoy following along. I'm so excited for y'all to find out where this story leads, but we're not quite there yet, and beginnings are something that are meant to be savored in this life, so I'm going to slow myself down and focus on getting our story underway. That said, I hope you're feeling cozy and comfortable, because here we go. Near about the northwest corner of this continent, only a barrel full of miles or so from the sloping cliffs of the Pacific coast, where rock becomes sand and sand becomes sea, there used to live a rambling sort of man I want to tell you about. A rambling sort of man who lived about 150 years ago, give or take a decade or two, who spent many happy years shrouded in the mists of the northwest woods, where the sky can turn 10,000 shades of gray before you've finished your breakfast. Now, this irresistible rambler's name was Mr. Beauregard Feller, but I bet you, like most folks from Minnesota to Madagascar, know him better as the one and only Lumber Dandy. Now, given how extraordinary his life and deeds were, there's a lot of Lumber Dandy stories out there. There's that famous one about the time he sucked up all the water in Puget Sound and spat out a rain spray so strong it saved old Seattle from a 12-alarm fire. And there's that time he darned 127 pairs of socks in 1 hour to save the frostbitten toes of a hard-working crew building the rest of us a railroad. But the story I want to tell you today happened before both of those, during our friend Beauregard Feller's earliest travels through the Northwest woods, after he'd journeyed up from Texas, but before he'd gotten himself known far and wide as the one and only Lumber Dandy. Yep, this story takes place back when even Beau himself was only a quarter sure of what he wanted to get and what he wanted to give in his one and only life. This, my friends, is the tale of how the Lumber Dandy got his famous lavender axe. Beau had been winding his way through the woods for 3 days without seeing another human, when all of a sudden a rock whizzed past his left ear and smacked an innocent tree trunk with a heavy thunk. Well, that's curious, Beau thought, and took another step. And then another rock whizzed past his right ear. Well, that's even curiouser, Beau thought, and took another step. And then a barrage of 9 rocks shot out of the tree branches from all sides. There was no mistaking it. Somebody was aiming a slingshot right at Beau's head. Or a few somebodies with a few slingshots, it seemed. Now, the rocks kept coming, and Beau smiled because he was itching for a bit of sport. He let out a holler and started dodging those flying stones so gracefully it was more like dancing, which, according to Beau, was, like most things, one of his many specialties. Soon, he wanted to meet these invisible assailants, so he darted from tree to tree, shaking the trunks like maracas, trying to knock his opponents to the ground. Now, Beau was fast and strong, faster and stronger than any man he'd ever met or ever would meet if he did say so himself, not to mention kinder and braver and handsomer and stylish as all get out and, oh, so very humble. Yep, in those early days, our incorrigible Lumber Dandy never missed an opportunity to show off, especially when he felt he'd had himself a clever idea, which was often, or when he found himself in the company of a good-looking cowboy or mountain man he wanted to impress, which was often enough. Now, having had his fill of shaking those trunks, Beau picked up a huge fallen branch, thick as 30 baseball bats roped together, and started spinning like a top, whacking everything in his path. He got going so fast, the forest was vibrating like a box of tuning forks. And after that, it was all over. In a rustle and a rumble, those strangers took a tumble, and Bo's count had been correct. It was 9 dizzy men crash-landing out of 9 dizzy trees. Old Bo laughed and laughed as the men caught their breath. And one of the strangers, the biggest of the 9, and the one most obviously in need of a bath, stood up and turned to Bo with a fighting look. He growled that his name was Melvin Makewind, and he was the leader of this small but mighty crew of lumberjacks, and just what did this stranger think he was up to trespassing through their chopping spot? Bo was still giggling about the fun he'd had knocking the men off their perches, and he said his name was Beauregard Feller, just Bo for short, and he didn't recall seeing any no trespassing signs, and was Melvin's terse tone really necessary on such a lovely day? Now, it wasn't often that Melvin met someone he couldn't intimidate just by giving them the old Makewind family stink eye, and he didn't like the feeling this self-assured and smiley stranger was giving him. A lumberjack wearing a green carnation-patterned scarf, exuding an air of mystery, was sitting on a stump behind Melvin, getting a big kick out of Bo's nerve. Well, Bo noticed that and grinned at the jack, and they started stealing winks and glances at each other while the boss went on fussing and fuming. Bo hadn't had this much fun since yesterday, so he interrupted Melvin's rant to ask the other men if they had room for one more for supper, and if any of you boys felt like two-stepping, he wouldn't turn you down because he was still in a dancing mood. Melvin was wary of this stranger. Something seemed different about him, a kind of different Melvin had felt coming off a man a time or two before that got under his skin for reasons he couldn't quite explain. He didn't care for the little lilt in Bo's voice, too musical sounding for forest work, and the way he seemed so light in his boots he almost floated when he walked. Melvin didn't care for the way that Bo and the woodsman in the green carnation scarf were looking at each other, and he was bothered by the white and green checkered shirt that hugged Bo's thick body. It was too bright for forest work. Now, if Melvin had asked, Bo would have been glad to clue him in that the colors of his shirt were not white and green, but were, in fact, sheep's milk cream and summer spearmint. But Melvin didn't ask. He was too busy getting upset about the way Bo's hands darted around energetically when he talked, like two hummingbirds attached at the wrists. Melvin didn't know why this stranger couldn't just keep his hands caged in his pockets, rigid and unexpressive, where his granddaddy had always shouted at him is where a man's hands belonged, even if it means he can't chase fireflies. And Melvin was pride sore from getting knocked out of a tree in what he considered his own backyard, so he said he thought Bo better just move along. Well, the other jacks didn't say so, but they were a little sad to hear that. They were intrigued by this strange and confident fella who could dodge rocks like bullets and shake men from trees like cherries. Bo said he'd be on his way, but first he asked Melvin if he knew of any gifted tailors in the area, as he wanted to get an expert's advice in selecting a color of thread for some new coat buttons that would complement his copper belt buckle. Melvin laughed derisively and asked, shouldn't a man have a wife for that sort of thing? And Bo remained cheerful and replied that he had no interest in a wife and that he reckoned most women he knew probably had better things to do than sew buttons for their husbands, especially since any self-respecting man ought to be able to do something like that for himself. The jack with the green carnation scarf snorted a giggle, and Bo pressed on, knowing just what he was doing, asking about local barbers, seeing as he was overdue for a hot shave and a relaxing soak. Melvin said they didn't need barbers out here, because any self-respecting man who wasn't going to keep a beard ought to be able to shave his own neck with his own axe. Well, Bo thought to himself, oh, he'd like to try that sometime, just as Melvin repeated more pointedly this time that Bo had better turn around and head on out, because a man like him wasn't welcome around this crew. Oh, and that did it. A man like him? The forest froze in uneasy silence as Bo's mustache twitched, and his eyes gleamed with the hot-blooded pride he'd soon come to be known for all his life and long thereafter. He thought about knocking Melvin down with a single left hook because he could, or destroying him because he could with a few cutting words about his abandonment of basic hygiene. He thought about how frustrating it was to be dealing with such a rude fool when he could have been using that time to swap ghost stories with a wolf pack or challenge jumping salmon to an underwater hopscotch contest or just use the time to get to know his new friend in the green carnation scarf a little better. Mostly, Bo thought about how tired he was of men like Melvin being afraid of men like himself. And how, as usual, well, he was going to have to do something about it, whether he felt like it or not. And that's when he noticed it. The head of Melvin's axe, shining silver steel. It was the most elegant and sleek he'd ever seen. And just like that, Bo knew what he had to do. Regaining his good cheer, he challenged Melvin to a duel. But not a boring one with weapons. Nah, Bo had something more interesting in mind. A shaving duel. With axes, just like Melvin had said. Victory would go to whomever could give himself the closest and cleanest shave without nicking the skin of his neck. If Bo won, he'd take Melvin's axe for his own. If he lost, he'd give Melvin his boots and walk out of those woods backwards and barefoot and bound to tell people he met that a man like himself just wasn't man enough to overpower Mr. Melvin Makewind. Well, unless, of course, Melvin was afraid to go up against a man like Bo, and then they could just call the whole thing off. Now, Melvin and men like him are often susceptible to this kind of talk, and Bo and men like him do well to use it to their advantage. Melvin took Bo's bravado for foolishness and accepted the terms. The rest of the lumberjacks were so excited they forgot they were dead tired from 15 hours chopping wood and got everything ready in an instant. 2 pails of water, 2 pats of shaving soap, 2 badger hair brushes, and 2 washcloths that had seen better days. No mirrors. Melvin pulled out his axe, and Bo looked around realizing he didn't have one. And then the quietly charming Jack in the green carnation scarf walked up and gave him his own. And Bo figured, well, that was very nice. And also, better to shave with someone else's axe than his own fingernails. A lumberjack with a plaid eye patch split a log in 2, and that signaled the start of the duel. Bo got a slow start because he was preoccupied for a moment imagining how brilliantly that plaid eye patch would pair with his favorite winter cap. Melvin didn't think about such things, so he began with a rush and sloppily doused himself with water. He started slathering the foamy soap across his neck and jaw, while Bo meticulously applied the lather to his face in a single expert motion with the assurance of a master painter approaching a canvas. He felt good and grateful to be alive and kicking and grooming himself by the light of the setting sun and the majesty of these woods, even if he were only doing it to prove his pride against a blockhead like Melvin. Bo took up that borrowed axe, and his first cut was naturally flawless. Not a wisp of a speck of a shred of a whisker remained from the strip of lip he'd shaved. Bo winked at his scarf-wearing ally, and his confidence swelled. And if there's one thing everybody knows about the lumber dandy, it's that when Bo's confidence swelled, well, so did his whole body. He started getting bigger with every pass of the axe. By the time he'd shaved half his face, he'd grown 3 feet upward and 4 shoe sizes outward. The lumberjacks were astonished and couldn't help but cheer. Melvin, for his part, was shaving steadily. He didn't have Bo's panache, but he'd been shaving with his own axe for going on 30 years, and he knew what he was doing. In those early days, Bo was as susceptible to flattery as Melvin was smelly. Having the full attention of 8 woodsmen, he couldn't help himself, so he hurled his axe so high up in the air, it cut a few passing clouds into coins. And the lumberjacks oohed and aahed in impressed delight. Now, while the axe was in the air, Bo grabbed his rucksack and pulled out his scissors and gave himself a haircut, just a bit off the top and clean up the sides, before catching the axe just in time and throwing that axe right back up in the air so he could have a moment to trim his fingernails. Whistling a jaunty tune, he caught the axe again as he finished his manicure, and the men roared with respect. Bo grew another 6 feet taller and 7 shoe sizes outward. He still had half a face to shave, and Melvin was getting pretty darn close to being done, but Bo wasn't sweating one little bit. He threw that axe skyward a third time, even harder than before, sending it so high it sliced an asteroid in two. And while it was up there, Bo changed his socks, and he shined his boots, and he washed his undershirt in the soapy water. He took a moment to shake giant hands with each of the lumberjacks, and that's how he came to find out that the quietly charming man in the green carnation scarf went by the name of Porter. Porter Paisley, who'd come over the trail a few years ago from Kentucky and never looked back. Now, feeling confident from being himself and making new friends, Bo grew another 5 feet taller and as many shoe sizes outward. Melvin screeched to the crew not to be taken in by Bo's showboating, as this was a shaving contest and none of that prissing and prancing about meant a darn about the winner. Though secretly, even Melvin was pretty impressed by his opponent's skills, not to mention the fact that he was suddenly 20 feet tall. And then Bo started moving fast as he could, which by now y'all know is just a tick or two slower than lightning when it's ticked off, because he had an idea. He pulled 10 stumps out of the ground and set them up in a circle. He found a tanned hide and stretched it between the stumps to make a table. He sped around, finding root vegetables and berries, and combined those with a few supplies he saw peeking out of the crew's knapsacks and got a delicious stew going. Yes, sir, he was the kind of man who wasn't just going to turn his adversaries into allies. He was going to serve them a feast in the process, too. Table set. Stew pot bubbling over the fire and the scent of cedar in the air. The axe finally tumbled down from outer space and landed magnetic-like in Bo's hand. A quick glance at his opponent, Melvin was only 2 strokes away from finishing. Bo gripped his axe like an extension of his hand and led it around the unshaven half of his face, finishing up a quarter second before Melvin shouted that he was done. And for a moment there appeared to be a tie, and Melvin insisted he'd called done a quarter second before Bo, who simply shook his head, displayed his smooth and immaculately shaven neck to the arena, and then pointed to Melvin. And there, almost imperceptible to the human eye, but there nonetheless, was the tiniest little droplet of blood peeking out of the tiniest little nick on the boss's thick neck. Bo had won. Not that he was surprised. And before Melvin could get down on himself, and even though he'd treated Bo so meanly, Bo shook his hand and invited everyone to dinner. And what a feast they had. The stew pot seemed to refill itself by magic whenever someone wanted seconds or thirds or elevenths. Bo taught those lumberjacks some cowboy songs he'd learned during his Texas years romping with the legendary Lance Spurwell. And the Jacks taught Bo some new table games like Hide the Parsnip and Poke the Skunk and Four Card Jinx. Melvin told surprisingly philosophical stories about growing up on the edge of Oregon Territory. And Porter Paisley played a banjo melody so sweet nobody wanted to break the silence that followed. The fire burned away in the starlight. There was work to be done and morning would come quick, so Melvin signaled it was past time to hit the sack. He then turned to Bo in front of everyone and handed over his axe. He apologized for the way he'd acted earlier and added that as boss, he had the largest tent and the most extra blankets and would be honored to host Bo for the night. Bo was quite touched by the gesture, but he couldn't resist messing with him a bit. That's awful kind of you, Mel, but I think I'll bunk with Porter over here. I could tell the moment y'all fell out of those trees that he's the only one here who could handle sleeping next to a man like me. And the Jacks erupted in laughter and got ready for bed. Bo shared Porter's tiny tent that night, and they stayed up talking all night long. Porter agreed to set off with him for Astoria Town the next morning, saying he had some personal business there and was ready to be off Melvin's crew anyhow. Bo grinned. Neither of them knew it at the time, but that night marked the beginning of a year-long partnership that led to what folks in the know from Tacoma to Baltimore now refer to as the Intrepid Expedition and Rip-Roaring Adventures of Beauregard Feller, the one and only Lumber Dandy, and Mr. Porter Paisley, the enigma known as the Ascot Punk. But that, friends, well, that's a tale for another day, and we haven't even finished this one yet. Now, next episode features Lance Spurwell, another very important character in Bo's life and a big part of Lumber Dandy and Friends in general. And I can't wait for the story of the next episode. It's one that's very near and dear to my heart. And then after that, we will be picking back up with Bo and Porter here in the woods in the third episode for the continuation of how the Lumber Dandy got his famous lavender axe. You know, I was thinking a lot about the notion of grit when I was getting ready to share this story with y'all. Now, different people might have slightly different ideas about what grit means, or at least what it means to them. But what I'm thinking of when I'm saying that I was thinking about grit is that little flint spark of determination in your spirit, in your guts. I know you got it. It tells you to stand up for yourself. Or to get back up if, like me, you get knocked down from time to time. You know, I think it's grit that hollers at you to stand up for yourself as you're making your way through this life toward wherever it is your own unique heart breeze is blowing you. And that's not always easy to do, of course, especially on days when it seems everybody and their Aunt Trudy woke up with a mind made up to treat you like the bullseye on their personal dartboard. And that's where grit comes in. It'll keep you going, keep you striving, keep you from giving up and giving in until you've given all you got to give and then some. And one thing I love about Bo is that he's got ample grit. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. It's an incredible joy to know that you're out there, and I just hope that you enjoyed the story and that you'll keep coming back and share some new ones with us in the coming weeks. Find us on the internet at lumberdandy.com or on social media. We're on Instagram and YouTube. You can also reach out to us on Twitter if you like. And send us an email if you have any questions or kind regards. We'd love to hear from you. And until then, take care, take it easy, and don't forget to slow down and enjoy yourself every day, just as you are.